This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us today. The Radio Boston team is taking a holiday pause this week, and as we do that, we are bringing you some of our favorite recent conversations, from the Best Book Conversations yesterday to tomorrow's hour, where we revisit conversations on living LGBTQ in 2021. But for today on this show, we want to go back almost a full year to January 2021 and hear from four Black leaders on how they see Boston today and tomorrow.
In the wake of violence and treason, which has rocked our country and reminded us exactly how fragile our nation and our democracy are, if these attacks and the atrocities of the last 4 years have shown us anything, it is the critical importance of speaking truth to power.
Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley there from the 2021 Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Breakfast. In fact, all four of the conversations you'll hear today took place on MLK Day in 2021, just days after a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, after a year of a pandemic, and a year of protest and speaking truth to power about Black lives, leadership, and justice. And it's also worth noting, it was before Boston Mayor Marty Walsh became Labor Secretary and Boston City Councilor Kim Janey became the city's first Black mayor. Our first conversation is with activist Monica Cannon Grant. She is the founder and CEO of the nonprofit Violence in Boston, focused on advocating for marginalized communities. When we spoke with her earlier this year, she was leading a protest in Roxbury, and we began with the message of that specific action.
We have some demands on things that need to happen locally. I mean, you know, we watch what happened at the Capitol as activists and as Black people, and so many things came to mind. The fact that they were able to still live after doing what they did. And we know that there was a casualty, but we've protested and the violence that we've been subjected to has been far worse. You know, making sure that that's known and saying it out loud, I think, is important. And then also highlighting that at a time like this, the thought that we're supposed to be building police community relations is unfathomable, being that a lot of those who were outside of the Capitol were police officers.
Monica, we don't know about the presence of Boston police officers at the Capitol other than one. There is a suspected one officer. So how do you think about that with the Boston police officers, especially given that you've now changed the march? It's now a rally at Madison Park High School instead of going all the way to the Capitol. You tweeted today, due to intel we've been gathering all week, we will not march to the State House. We will rally at Madison Park only. I do not want my people harmed by law enforcement or white supremacists. Talk a little bit more about that.
Police and white supremacists are one and the same oftentimes, and we watched it transpire, and I don't want Black folks to lose their life. In regards to the one officer that you guys know about, that's just the one that we know about. And understanding how this has went thus far, I don't want it to be that Black folks lose their life peacefully protesting, because we get killed and we get harmed and we get pepper sprayed for way less than what was allowed at the Capitol. In fact, BLM has protested in that same location and not even been allowed to get that close to the Capitol. And so, based on information that we had, I didn't want to jeopardize the lives of those who are out there protesting by having them go down there in unfamiliar territory and not knowing who's coming after them. If it's the police or white supremacy, just to minimize harm, I'd rather not.
Your Twitter handle is Pro Rock Thrower. And I wonder, do you feel like somebody who's standing outside the system and throwing rocks at it here in Boston? And if so, do you think you'll ever work from inside the system, or do you think as you've gained credibility, notoriety, awareness as a leader in Boston, that you'll begin to move inside the system as well?
No. I've gotten more work done. I've been able to achieve more resources for my community on the outside. There are those that can work within that system, and to them, I tip my hat. I will not be entering into that system. What I believe is that I've gotten thus far because of my ability to metaphorically throw rocks, because of my ability to highlight injustices, because of my ability to protest, but also because of my ability to provide the very resources that we are demanding that those that are in position of power to provide, and they have not thus far. I think people would love to believe that Boston is different, but this is one of the most racist cities in the country. And we watch it transpire on a regular basis through policy and decision-making through our elected officials. And when you look at all the elected officials in the city of Boston. Although we've recently had some changes, and there are changes coming in the future, it is a clear indicator of what we're up against. And so there's always going to be a reason to protest, and there's always going to be a reason to fight, and the understanding that protesting has to be a part of politics.
Okay, so I want to ask you then, when did you become a rock thrower? You know, we talked about your handle being pro rock thrower. You said you metaphorically throw rocks. When did that start for you, and why?
That started when my street was shot up 15 times. I stood next to someone and they put a gun to my son's head and pulled the trigger. And there were no answers. There were no resources and there were no answers. Nobody could tell me why it was okay for the black and brown kids on my street to witness 15 shootings in one summer, some of them being at 3 o'clock in the afternoon while they were standing at ice cream trucks, and more people weren't outraged. And it wasn't that we didn't have the resources, it's that those resources were not allocated to my community the same way they were allocated to other communities.
How is your son?
He's 22 now. He was 14 when it transpired.
I can't even imagine as a mother. I can't imagine, Monica.
Yeah.
We have talked a number of times on air with a good friend of the show, Tito Jackson, who I know has tremendous respect for you and has mentored you. And it made me wonder, are you mentoring another generation of activists right now? And if you are, what are you focusing on as you help develop them?
Absolutely. I think it is disrespectful to not mentor those coming behind us and those who are already doing the work and just need information or maybe just a slight bit of guidance. What I'm telling them is understanding that it's cool to throw rocks and show up as your authentic self, but also do your homework, do your intel, learn the system. Politics is a part of protesting. So to say I'm just a protester or I'm just an activist and organizer and I'm not into politics leaves out a crucial piece, because oftentimes legislation and decision making purposefully affects communities of color. So educating them on that, and then also building a network so they have access to capital. You can't do this work and not have some type of financial support. And so whatever piece of knowledge I can pass, I'm more than willing to pass, because, you know, this notion that we can do this work forever, burnout is real. Activists get tired. So we have to keep it going. And the way you keep it going is to pass on information.
You are known for paying really close attention to details, for running tightly run protests where people follow your directions, for thinking about things like asking black men in the community to provide extra security and awareness. Where did you learn that skill set? And what do you tell younger organizers about the details of organizing the kinds of protests and rallies that you often do?
I learned it from an organizer of the Black Lives Matter movement out of Cambridge. And just empowering people in our community to understand that, you know, oftentimes we have depended on the police and different entities to protect us. But if you empower people, they are more than willing to protect, stand up, and support their own community. But I'm from this community. And so why not tap into the people in this community that want to be a part of something, who care, who are always deemed people who don't care, or deemed as animals, or deemed as so many other negative things, and empower them to understand that we can protect our own. We can take care of our own. We can feed our own, and we can support our own.
I want to play a bit of a speech that Martin Luther King Jr. gave when he was accepting the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, Norway, in December of 1964. Here he is.
Nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time. The need for man to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to violence and oppression. Civilization and violence are antithetical concepts.
You have become known throughout Boston for being able to hold rallies and protests that push hard on the system, that throw metaphorical rocks, as you say, and also carry forward nonviolence in that protest. Did Dr. King's work motivate or inspire you? And would you agree with the way he laid that out just now today?
Dr. King is definitely an inspiration, but that's just one way to think about civil rights. I think that my mindset is more along the lines of Malcolm X. I think I'm more than willing to peacefully protest, of course, but I also believe that even in the midst of peacefully protesting, Martin Luther King was told, he was beat, he was assaulted. As we're watching today in 2021, even when we're peacefully protesting, screaming Black Lives Matter, we're beaten, we're assaulted, we're pepper sprayed. We have Black people who are being killed by police officers for sleeping, smoking cigarettes, selling cigarettes, walking away in their house, eating ice cream. So at this point, I have the mindset that it doesn't matter what position you are in, that being Black is essentially a threat to this country. And I guess my question for the powers that be is, how long do you want us to peacefully protest while you beat the hell out of us?
Monica, you have become a leader to be reckoned with in the city of Boston. What is your vision for our city?
What I would like to see in the city of Boston and across this country is equity. We have yet to deal with all the transgressions that we have been subjected to as Black people in this country. And it doesn't happen every time we put a Black person in a position of leadership, because that's one symbol. What we need is true equity. When you look at the numbers, the wealth of a white family, the net worth of a white family is $246,000. The net worth of a Black family is $8, and it's due to drop. That is disgraceful for a city that is thriving. When you cross Mass Ave, life expectancy drops 30 years. So there's no way anyone can tell me that Boston and furthermore Massachusetts is doing great. I guess my hope is that in this fight that we begin to make traction. I don't believe that civil rights is going to be won in my generation. But one of the things my grandmother says is that it's won in every generation. Every generation, we get a few steps closer, and that's my hope.
Activist Monica Cannon Grant. She is the founder and CEO of the nonprofit Violence in Boston, focused on advocating for marginalized communities. We spoke with her in January of 2021 on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Our focus that day was around this question: who are the young leaders of color in Boston, Massachusetts, and beyond that you're watching and supporting, and how do they embody the legacies of Dr. King and Coretta Scott King? So naturally, we turn to State Representative Liz Miranda, who represents Massachusetts' 5th Suffolk District, which includes Dorchester, Roxbury, and Mattapan, asking this question: how's she holding up in 2021?
You know, I'm okay today. I woke up with a real spirit of fighting and a real fire in me to this Dr. King memorial observance of his birthday would be a little different. And I feel that it's been very different since I woke up this morning.
What feels different about it?
It feels different because I think we're telling more of a true, we're sharing a truer history and legacy about the civil rights movement in this country. We're in the middle of a racial reckoning among many pandemics happening at once. And I think that one of the things that I have always appreciated about people like Monica Cannon and other activists in our city is that they really tell us the truth and they hold a mirror up to leaders in our community to realize that the work that we've begun is still not done. It actually feels like it's just beginning.
You know, one of the things that you and Monica Cannon Grant have in common is community organizing, being organizers. I still vividly remember at the Republican National Convention in 2008, several keynote speakers there made fun of then-candidate Barack Obama for having been a community organizer because they didn't think those skills would transfer. How have your organizing skills transferred to your work as an elected representative at the State House?
It's at the core of everything I am and how I legislate and how I govern with the people in my community. I was 13 years old when I went to my first community cleanup and finally realized that I had the power to actually change my conditions. I grew up in the Roxbury's, in a section of Roxbury called the Dudley Triangle, and there's two movies and a book called Streets of Hope about my community where everyday people, many of them who could not even speak English, got up and fought the city in one eminent domain of their land, and they started the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. And that organization really changed my life and saved my life. When I think about the work that I did to get into office, it was all about resident leadership and building power in community for community. And that's something I really strongly believe in and something that I've carried throughout my work in dismantling racism, creating economic opportunity, this police reform bill that just passed, addressing maternal health and environmental justice. It all comes from that little girl who was 13 years old, who wanted more, who lived in a community that knew that 1,400 parcels of vacant land was not a good thing, who knew that trash transfer stations that were illegal, that were making us sick, didn't belong there. You know, Monica mentioned dying 30 years before our brothers and sisters in the Back Bay, and this is a community that I was born and raised and I live in today. So it's at the forefront of my mind every day, and I think it's helped me create basically pathways and pipelines for other people in my community to add value to the betterment of our neighborhood.
How could we achieve real resident leadership in the city of Boston?
You know, one of the things that I've learned since I've been, you know, 2 years in government, I'm super excited that I got reelected, but I'm only one of four Black women in the entire Massachusetts legislature. And when we look at the history of Massachusetts legislature, there's been only about 13 Black and Latino women to ever serve in its 380 some odd year history. And we cannot achieve, and I feel really strongly about this, we cannot achieve the goals of really resident leadership or changing our city for the better, or our Commonwealth for the better, until we believe in racial justice work. I believe it's the foundation of our progress. We need to bring different types of people who are struggling and suffering with things like being unhoused, being poor, being marginalized due to their sexuality or faith into the fold of our government. The government not only needs to be centered on helping those most in need, but being led by what they believe needs to be done. You know, I have an advisory circle of people in my community from every walk of life. My mom still works in the back of Boston hotels as a cook. And that experience of being in a family of a low-wage worker and a union worker has really changed my perspective. When COVID hit, I knew what to do because I knew what it's like to be poor. I knew what it's like to be food insecure, to live in a community that never fully realized its dream. So I think that first step is being honest and truthful and focusing on racial justice. And racial justice work is also economic justice work for me. And then bringing different people into the fold.
I'd like to play a little tape for you, because this is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. This is Dr. King accepting the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, Norway, December 1964. And he's talking about poverty and how the wealthy ignore the needs around them. Here it is.
The well-off and the secure have too often become indifferent and oblivious to the poverty and deprivation in their midst. The poor in our countries have been shut out of our minds and driven from the mainstream of our societies because we have allowed them to become invisible. Just as nonviolence exposed the ugliness of racial injustice, so must the infection and sickness of poverty be exposed and healed, not only its symptoms, but its basic causes.
We often on Martin Luther King Jr. Day focus on his messages of unity, his I Have a Dream speech, but he was a fierce critic of our country's failure to address poverty and equity. What are the big agenda items that you feel we have to bring forward, respecting his legacy, respecting his criticism on poverty and your own commitment to change?
It's really interesting that we've really pacified his existence here in America. You know, just like my younger brother, Dr. King was murdered. He was assassinated. And I've been reading two different speeches a lot. One is I've Been to the Mountaintop, and then The Three Evils, and where he talks about one important line about African Americans' determination to be people, and then understanding that poverty and racism and war, and I'd like to expand war to be sort of anything around law enforcement, law and order, is really the fundamental parts of his movement and message. You know, we talk a lot about unity, but there can be no unity without truth and reconciliation. There can be no unity without justice. And I believe that the only way we get there is a radical redistribution of economic and political power. We're going to be in a mayor's race very soon. I believe that that person not only needs to be a person of color, but also a person who deeply believes in racial justice and progressive values. It is a person that needs to focus on the same policy agenda of alleviating poverty. You know, our city is not stronger when people who live in communities like Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan can't get a good union job. If they can't work for Boston Water and Sewer or for the government or get a job that pays them well over $80,000, we see this overdependence on service jobs and gig jobs that have been evaporated by COVID. We see an investment, a need in public health, the equitable distribution of wealth and resources. Monica talked about this $8 to $250,000 in wealth. We cannot wait. We don't have the luxury of time of trying to get to that $8 to $250,000 incrementally. We have to do something very radical. And we have to advance decarceral policies to end mass incarceration. You know, my district is over-policed, over-incarcerated, and we're still not safe. You know, we make up over 60% of the mass DOC population, yet we make up only 20% of the population in Massachusetts, that being Black and Latino people. We also need to focus on radically improving our public school, voc tech, and community college education system. That is the great equalizer for me, is education. With a strong education, you know, 6 out of 10 Boston school graduates don't go and finish college. You know, I went to Wellesley undergrad after coming out of Boston's exam schools. My mom dropped out of Madison Park to have me. We've lived totally two different lives. And until we can realize that for every Bostonian, every young person, I think we'll be failing. And I really want to encourage anyone who's thinking about running for office or even running for city council or mayor, particularly here in Boston, to think about what is your vision and agenda for Boston's young people. My commitment is still the same as I walked into the halls of Beacon Hill on January 2nd, 2019, which is to focus on those most marginalized, our undocumented immigrants and refugees, people who are living at the fringe of society, who are unhoused, who are dealing with addiction, those who are incarcerated. And what Dr. King said in that speech resonates with me, that really we have a bunch of people that are invisible. We're not oblivious to them. We just choose not to see and hear and involve them. We see them every day in our communities, and we're not investing what we need to invest appropriately to make sure that everyone in Boston can have a good job with good wages, can afford to live here, have enough food and a great education. And those are the fundamental, I think, pieces of thriving, you know, to be healthy, live in a safe community full of opportunity.
State Representative Liz Miranda there, who represents Massachusetts' 5th Suffolk District, including Dorchester, Roxbury, and Mattapan, speaking with us on Martin Luther King Jr. Day earlier this year. As the Radio Boston team takes a break this week, we are revisiting some of our favorite conversations from the year. This hour, 4 Black leaders on how they see Boston today and in the future. When we come back after a short break, we'll hear our conversation with Imari Paris Jeffries, the executive director of King Boston, on how we put the King legacy into a contemporary context. I'm Tiziana Deering, and you're listening to Radio Boston. We are on a holiday break this week, so we are bringing you some of our favorite hours of the show, looking back at 2021. This hour, Black leaders on how they see the city and their vision for the future. We spoke to them on Martin Luther King Jr. Day this year. Before the break, we heard from Monica Cannon Grant, the founder and CEO of the nonprofit Violence in Boston, and State Representative Liz Miranda. Now, Imari Paris Jeffries, the executive director of King Boston, a nonprofit working to build a sculpture and implement other programming to honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King. When we spoke, King Boston had teamed up again with the Museum of Fine Arts to produce Voices on King, a film that brought together some of the city and state's leading voices to share their thoughts on King's legacy in Boston and beyond.
There's no doubt that we have a long way to go toward realizing the vision and goals of Dr. Martin Luther King and Coretta Scott King. There are deep and systemic challenges for people of color across our society.
I encourage people to not think that the Kings were so long ago. We are in the same fight that they were in before, and I am proud to be leading in this area.
mean, there's so many ways to keep the work of the Kings alive. I would say that, you know, it's happening all over the city. It's happening in this museum every day. And that for me is not as much the question as is what happens when you get tired. What happens when you get frustrated? What happens when you feel like your work is not moving fast enough? And I think those are the moments where we best think of him and his spirit.
Those voices, of course, Governor Charlie Baker, Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins, just confirmed to be U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, and Makeba McCreary, then the MFA's Chief of Learning and Community Engagement, and now President of the New Commonwealth Racial and Equity Social Justice Fund. Turning now to our conversation with Imari Paris Jeffries of King Boston, and I should note, Imari and I worked together in the past at an organization called Boston Rising. We began with this idea of paying attention in a new way during the pandemic, protests for racial justice after an insurrection.
I feel like we are paying attention in a new way, and I think today, especially today, I'm brought to an Audre Lorde quote. And she talks about, I have come to believe that caring for self is not self-indulgent. Caring for self is an act of survival, especially on a Dr. King Day like the one that we're having today after the year that we've had, after the events of the 6th. I think it's important that this Dr. King Day be a day of self-reflection, self-care, and joy. Because the act of joy is an act of resistance.
That makes me think of Janae Osterhelt of the Boston Globe and her series, The Beautiful Resistance, where she talks about Black joy. And that is not a framing, Imari, that has been part of the mainstream white conversation about Black participation in protest, in our political culture, et cetera. How are we beginning to change the narrative about Black Boston, Black leadership in today's moment?
You know, I think through a King Boston lens and Tiziana, I hope when you see King Boston, you see the work that you and I started 10 years ago come to fruition in a way that I think we weren't ready as a city and a country. And you know, thinking about several parts of King Boston, the Embrace Memorial in a time where we're talking about symbols and other places are tearing down monuments, including here, both with the Columbus Memorial, the Columbus Monument, and the Emancipation Memorial. Boston is one of the few cities in the country building a memorial, not only to the Kings, but to Boston civil rights leaders. And so we understand that symbols matter, that spatial justice matter. So the fact that this memorial is placed in one of our country's oldest parks matters. It is a sign that Boston is a welcoming city, that we're moving towards being a better city that's more inclusive. And, you know, a lot of surveys have placed Boston at the bottom of major cities of being one of the most unwelcoming cities. And I would argue that we've heard them. And I would argue that the report that came out in the Spotlight series was heard, and that people in Boston and the Commonwealth took that seriously, and that we are in the midst of a third reconstruction. And as evidenced by Representative Miranda, as evidenced by a Monica Cannon Grant, as evidenced by an emergence in a national way of Congresswoman Presley, our two top law officials being African-American, our top law official, the DA, being African-American, our two foundation heads, the top foundations in Massachusetts, both Barr and the Boston Foundation, being headed by Latinx and an African-American male, respectively. The mayoral race, which promises, at least in the short term, to have our mayor in waiting be a Black woman, and having our candidates, our top candidates in this race, being two women, both an Asian and a Black woman. And so this is a part of this third reconstruction. I think that we are in the midst of this transformation. And I'm excited. I think King Boston exists because this transformation has taken place, because Bostonians and folks in the Commonwealth have taken seriously a commitment to racial equity and justice.
Amari, you've talked about a third Reconstruction a couple of times. Can you walk us through the first two in your mind? I fear asking an obvious question, but I always find you look at the world differently, and I'd like to hear you talk through that.
Yeah, you know, and I think some would argue that the first two, the first one being, you know, directly after the Civil War and the emergence of Black elected officials and emergence of institutions that existed and were created to ensure African Americans, Black Americans had the right to exist. And so that was immediately after Civil War. The second one, some would argue, World War II to throughout the Civil Rights Movement.
You are cutting out significantly. I'm having a little trouble with your sound. So
I'm back on sale. Sorry about that. I should have paid my internet bill. That's what I did for waiting the last minute. It's great to be back.
Great to have you back. Could have been us too, Amari. So listen, you were walking us through. You had made a reference to the third Reconstruction. You had told us about the first, and I had asked you if you could tell us the second Reconstruction, and you're saying that today is our third. Tell us about the second Reconstruction.
The second, some historians frame the second Reconstruction, the period after World War II leading up to the 70s, and so this moment in time, this day where we're celebrating Martin Luther King, was the conclusion of what some argued as the second Reconstruction, you know, the Civil Rights era. This third Reconstruction, Reverend Barber, who is the head of the NAACP in Charlotte and one of the national leaders around this reimagined poor people's campaign, has framed this period in time that we're in as a third Reconstruction. So, you know, one might argue that the election of Pastor Warnock in, you know, Senator-elect Warnock in Georgia, is part of that third Reconstruction, this emergence of Black political, civic, and elected leaders really taking a role in our country, and especially in our Commonwealth. I think we see some of that happening right now.
So, you know what, I'm mindful of the fact that you've talked about so much change. You mentioned the work we did together 10 years ago, and maybe the city wasn't ready then for the level of change that we're beginning to see now. I'm also mindful that when change happens, people push back, Amari, and sometimes they push back hard. Not that pushback isn't important, but how do we keep the oxygen to new, emerging, challenging Black leaders who are going to tell us a different story about ourselves, tell us a different story about what we have to do next? Where does that strength come from, and how do we bond a community together to keep that space open?
And Tiziana, this is, you know, you and I struggled with this work, you know, 10 years ago, and it's still a challenge. You know, I think even thinking about the 1619 Project and the founding of our country, you know, we've all been, Dr. Kendi would argue that we've all been socialized into racism through the founding of our country. It's an endemic, not a pandemic. Many of our institutions are rooted in and grounded in systemic racism, and it's hard for white folks and even communities of color to imagine a different way of being. It is like finding out the Easter Bunny, Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy, all of them doesn't exist. It is an epistemological fracture that people are having. Everything that we know to be true is not true. What do you do? And so for some of the folks, it looks like anger, like we saw last week. And for some of the folks, it looks like Karenism. It looks like folks being uncomfortable witnessing Black joy. You know, I think Representative Miranda talked about Black joy and our inability to see people comfortable, relaxing, self-care. And so this is also a part of this spatial justice discourse. Where can Black and brown bodies be safe? In a city of our size and magnitude, we have 8 to 9 entertainment licenses that belong or are owned by African Americans, by Black folks in this city. And so places of entertainment doesn't exist for people of color. And so this is part of the fight. This is part of the work that we have to do. I think our partnership with the MFA, McKeeble was brought on because was the Museum of Fine Arts a safe space? Could you be your full self? I think the police reform bill that we've all fought to get passed was also about spatial justice. It was about safety. 1/3 of shootings of Black folks happen at traffic stops by police officers. So 1/3 of police sanctioned or police shootings, and Monica probably mentioned some of this, happens during travel traffic stops. So can black bodies be safe driving? And so there's really this connection between joy, well-being, and spatial justice that has emerged as part of the anti-racist discourse. There's one piece where we're interrogating policy, we're interrogating data, we are interrogating research, we're creating new policy data and research. And there's another space where we have to raise up well-being, joy, self-care. And those are two concentric circles that must overlap in order for us to imagine us moving out of this third reconstruction successfully.
Imari Paris Jeffries, the executive director of King Boston, a nonprofit working to build a sculpture and implement other programming to honor Dr. King and Coretta Scott King. He spoke with us earlier this year on Martin Luther King Jr. Day as part of a special hour with four black leaders on how they see the city and their vision for the future. When we come back after a short break, we will bring you our final conversation of the hour with Michael Bobbitt, who was stepping down then as artistic director at New Repertory Theater to take the helm of the Mass Cultural Council. He'll share with us his vision for the region and what the arts mean for us today. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to this special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. As the Radio Boston team takes a holiday break, we are continuing to bring you some of our favorite conversations on the show this week from the past year. This hour, talking with black leaders in the region about their vision for the future. We had these conversations on Martin Luther King Jr. Day this year, weeks after a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Earlier this hour, we heard from activist Monica Cannon Grant. She is the founder and CEO of the nonprofit Voices in Boston, focused on advocating for marginalized communities. Then, State Representative Liz Miranda and Imari Paris Jeffries, the executive director of King Boston. Finally, we want to revisit our conversation with Michael Bobbitt, who was just stepping down as artistic director at New Repertory Theater to take the helm of the Mass Cultural Council, on his vision for the region and what the arts mean for us today. We began with this question. When did he know he wanted to be an artist?
Funny story. I was Hansel in the third grade of, in the third act of the first grade of Hansel and Gretel, and my mom thought it was the best act, even though there were three other Hansels, and I will go on record saying that she was not biased. I think that my performance of Hansel in the third act of Hansel and Gretel was by far greater. So I think it started way back in first grade.
So what now? So now you've come through so much. You've played classical trumpet. You've been the artistic director for two theaters. Now you're going to run a cultural council for the entire Commonwealth. What do you want to help the arts bring to our communities?
You know, it's an interesting thing because at this point, I don't even know where the files are. I literally haven't opened up an email or turned on my computer. And I tend to work in collaboration with other artists. So I want to get in there and the people that I'm working with, I want to get in there and talk to the artists, talk to the arts organizations, talk to the staff, talk to the partner organizations in the council to kind of figure out together what we want to do. I do know I want to bring more visibility to the arts, to let the Commonwealth and legislators of this county know how much arts means to the count, to the Commonwealth, and how much money we put back into the economy. I certainly want to make sure that the arts and funding for the arts is equitable and just. I want to uplift and support all the arts agencies and find ways to make our fantastic individual artists, these really gig performers who make the world move, to have more sort of support and a different way of living outside of going gig to gig to gig.
You talked about equity and funding. You know, today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and all our guests so far this hour have said today is a different one. It feels different. It feels like we're walking into it differently, prepared to observe it differently. What can the arts do to carry forward their legacy, their inspiration and vision on equity and poverty, equity and race in our country and here in the Commonwealth?
You know, the best thing about art and artists is that I believe that the imagination is seeing the world different. I believe that creativity is bringing imagination to life. And I believe that artists and art is the product of creativity, and artists bring that to life. So all that we want to do, how we want to recover from COVID, how we want to get to a more just and equitable world, we need to include artists in that. There are no other experts on this planet that can imagine a world that is equitable and just than artists. I marvel at playwrights who can have an idea in their head, share that script with a bunch of other people, and then anywhere from an hour to a year later, there is a production of a beautiful world up there. So artists can be part of all parts of society to help us get to where we're going. We've gotten to the technological age. We've gotten to the industrial age. Now it's time for us to move towards the creative age.
At the same time, Michael, you've been thoughtful and critical about arts program theater, for example, using Band-Aid approaches to increase diversity and equity, a term that you used in a piece for American Theater. So what do arts organizations in the Commonwealth need to change internally to advance that equity as well? What's your call to action there?
Well, I think this is not just applies to arts organization. It applies to any organization that exists as a predominantly white institution. Those organizations only exist that way because of racism. Not to say that the people working for them are bad people, but they've set up the system to serve predominantly white people, which means that there's things that you are doing in the creation, in the charter, in the bylaws, in the operations, in the policies and the practices that are excluding people. And we have to go back to look at that. We have to go back to look at the symptoms that are creating the core things that are creating the symptoms of racism. So it's not enough to just do a program or change a policy. You have to go back to the root and the heart of why you were formed and make sure that there's no racism or inequities or exclusion that exists in every single aspect of your organization. This is a huge deep dive. And I would say this is what the country needs to do too. I think democracy is a great idea. I just don't know if we've done a good job at it. And partly that's because the people that have made the rules have all been homogenous. And if we want to make the rules that really take care of everyone, we have to make sure that people in leadership positions represent the nation that we have put together. I'm so excited about Biden's, the people he's putting on his team, because they will help us get to a more equitable place.
Michael, what rules would you make?
That's a good question. It's hard to answer because I want to make sure I collaborate with all of my colleagues and those that are benefiting from the arts, including the taxpayers whose money we get to appropriate to all these arts organizations. So I don't know. I mean, I think we just have to look at everything we're doing from an equitable place and fix those things that are not equitable.
What would be one thing that you could accomplish in the next year that would advance a vision for a more equitable Massachusetts? And why are you laughing at me for asking you that question?
because it's a very interesting question. And throughout the process, even in interviewing for the job, the question of what is your vision comes up. And I have a vision for the world, which is to be more equitable, to take care of those who are the most marginalized. But when it comes to how the agency is appropriating its money, it's hard to sort of know what those actual things will be. The one thing I will say is I hope to have conversations with almost all of my colleagues and pay special attention to those who are the most marginalized, because I do believe that there are two visions of the world. And I think one is more true than the other. One of the visions is the vision of the world from people with privilege and the vision of the world from people who are oppressed. And I sort of believe those who are oppressed have a clearer and more truer vision of the world. So talking to them and finding out what they need is huge, is a huge part of everything that I have done as an artist for my whole entire life.
Is there a moment in making art or experiencing art that stays with you every day, that motivates how you do your work, and that either inspires you or maybe corrects you? Is there a moment in your artistic life?
There is. I had this beautiful and wonderful experience to pioneer what is now known as sensory-friendly productions. I was at my last theater, which was a children's theater. I was producing a play called If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, Of course, terrible things happen if you give a mouse a cookie. So never give mice cookie, everyone. but I had a patron call, and she was just wanting to thank me for putting on this play, because she and her son were looking at the play. When I asked her when she was coming, because I really wanted to meet her and her son, she said she was not coming because her child was autistic and she didn't want him to disturb other people. And I was like, well, this is unacceptable. Let me find out from the actors if they would do the show for just you, your son, and your son. And the actors, of course, said yes. And so we launched our first ever sensory-friendly autism production of If You Give a Mouse a Cookie. And then I got to consult with Theater Development Fund and Disney Theatricals, who heard about this new model that we pioneered. And I got to consult with them on The Lion King on Broadway. And I remember the opening number of The Lion King, when all these large, beautiful puppets are coming down the aisle, to see an audience of 1,600 kids and their families who all have autism or Asperger's or other sensory issues enjoy this beautiful show because we made adjustments to help and support them was something I will never forget. And I had seen the show probably about 7 or 8 times prior to that. But that moment and that performance just stuck with me. I cried like a baby in that opening number, cried so hard. But that is what we have to do. We have to look at who is the most marginalized and take care of them. That should be how humans operate all the time. And it's not even a difficult concept. If someone doesn't have a house, let's get them a house. If someone doesn't have a car, let's get them a car. This is what we all should be doing.
That was Michael Bobbitt, who was just stepping down as artistic director at New Repertory Theater to take the helm of the Mass Cultural Council, speaking with us in January of this year on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Listeners, thanks for joining us today for this special hour. Tomorrow on Radio Boston, we revisit conversations on living LGBTQ in 2021, from an assessment of how far we have and haven't come, policy to pride, to the television show Pose and the life-giving role of our local ballroom scene, and then one high schooler's fight to play soccer with her teammates. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. It's produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, and Amanda Beland. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.